Well, I think I will get started. So this is the third session this week on Simple Living, and tonight I'm talking, like, basically climate engineering for dummies, I think I call this. My name is Ann Basie, I'm a housekeeper here at Holden, and I keep saying, keep plugging the book. Here's the brochures today about the book, Sustaining Simplicity, a journal published by the World Hunger Appeal, ELCA World Hunger Appeal. And as a disclaimer, you know, I'm not a climate engineer, I'm not an environmental engineer, I'm not a scientist, I'm an English major, but I think this is a topic that a lot of us are interested in, and I think when I read that quote, from here on out, we're all climate engineers, I put that in the description today, I ran across that at some point the last year reading, and I thought, you know, we sort of all are in the business now of affecting the climate one way or the other, so what I'd like to do tonight is just kind of, actually, I'm going to steal someone else's presentation that's about climate change, because I think it's so good. I wanted to start, though, first of all, if anybody's ever heard the term eco-anxiety. This is a new thing we can get. We can go to see our doctors about. It's I have in quotes here, eco-anxiety, the walking worried. Basically, eco-anxiety is now defined as a state of mind in which it's characterized by pervasive nervousness about global warming, toxins, and environmental destruction, resulting in anxiety and obsessions about saving the planet. So I think this may be something that is creeping up on us. It's nice to give it a name. So eco-anxiety is something that I think all of us, to some degree, are suffering right now, in part because, you know, we don't really know what's happening, how we got here, or what we can do about it. It feels just overwhelming. But a year ago in Chicago, I was at a great Earth Day conference in my neighborhood, and the weatherman made a presentation, and I took copious notes on everything except his name, and now when I Google him, I can't find him anyway, but this is, just so you know, this fabulous weatherman gave the most succinct presentation on climate change and global warming that I ever heard, so this is basically his presentation. He acknowledged that as a weatherman, he's in the business of making really complicated stuff really easy to understand and act on. And so he wanted to make sure that global warming and climate change wouldn't make our heads spin, but that he wanted to summarize what was happening, why it's happening, what that means to us, and what might change the scenarios that we're hearing and what we can do. So I'm basically going to give his speech. I'm not as clever as a weatherman, and he had lots of great slides and pictures and pointers, and I was just taking notes. First of all, I'll just define the terms the way that he defined them. So I have to check my notes a lot tonight, sorry. And again, I'll talk for a while and then we'll have discussion, same as we've had the other evenings. This weatherman, the smart weatherman, defined climate as the long-term average weather conditions of a region. And weather as the state of the atmosphere at a specific place and time. So today it's hot in Holden. So climate is what the weather is usually like. Climate change is mostly a statistical measurement about weather over the long time, and as he said, this is what puts us to sleep. You know, when scientists start talking about percentages and charts and ratios, it gets very difficult. But he said, but we all do understand climate variability. How is weather different now than it used to be? And in what ways is it changing? That's something that we can see every day. So even though climate change might leave our head spinning, this is something that we can see and begin to understand. So he said that climate variability is change in long-term weather patterns over months or years, something that we can observe. And as a weatherman, then, he had a lot of really great slides about some of the things that he's beginning to see, that as a weatherman who studied meteorology and, you know, the history of meteorology and the history of weather in the United States, he hadn't been seeing. This is a weatherman in the Chicago area, so we're talking about Midwestern climate. He was talking about snow and how it's true in Illinois. I lived there a number of years. I'm fond of skiing. We had many years with hardly any snow. Now we're getting years with lots of snow, but the snow comes early and it melts four times. There's four complete runoffs and four new snowstorms. So instead of having snow starting around January, covered till about March 15th, and then beginning to run, it starts at the end of November, and it maybe all melts by January 1st, comes again, melts again. So this kind of hot, cold, hot, cold, hot, cold thing is one thing he was pointing out, which leads to, in the Midwest, something he thought he could never see, and those are tornadoes in January. He said, "Something is not right when you see a tornado deposit debris on snow and frozen lakes." It's just a time of year when you think the tornado is nothing like we have to worry about. Today, did you know, and the churchwide assembly's happening, and it was kind of all interrupted for a tornado in downtown Minneapolis. Everybody's okay. But there was a touchdown, apparently, in Minneapolis. Things are okay, but anyway. But so it was a big thing at churchwide assembly today. I got a post from a colleague who works in worship. He said, "Today I had to choose a hymn for a tornado." It was a new challenge. So this wedding man was talking about, you know, some of the stuff that he just has seen in the Midwest that he just can't believe, and that this for us is kind of all we need as lay people to understand about the fact that weather's changing. Of course, this is the list of the 10 hottest years. He says that in the past 3 decades, the rate of warming in the global temperatures has been approximately 3 times greater than the whole of the previous century. So what would that be? Since 1979, the rate of warming of the global temperature is 3 times greater than back to, well, where should we go, maybe 1909, maybe? I don't know where he was counting that century. These are the most recent hottest years, and you can see that all of them have happened since 1995. This is number one hottest. 1998 was the hottest, and going down from here. You know, this was the part of his speech that had a lot of bad news in it. He noted that since 1979, more than 40% of the polar ice cap has melted away, and that the Greenland ice cap is also beginning to melt. In Lake Michigan, what that means for us is there's less ice on Lake Michigan, which keeps the lake temperature higher, which means it warms up earlier, cools down later, which leads to more lake effect snow, more evaporation, and we are having quite a drop in levels of the Great Lakes in depth. He noted then that this kind of climate change, the climate variability that we see and climate change that scientists track can be caused by natural external forces like volcanoes, like the El Nino effect, which maybe will produce, you know, I'm not a weatherman, does it make it warmer or cooler? I don't know, but it makes some changes. Something he called natural internal processes. Anybody know what that is? Any climatologists here? We'll skip it. And then human-induced or anthropogenic forces. And he then started to talk about carbon as the major anthropogenic or human-induced cause of global warming. And here is the simple math. So every year, we emit 7 billion tons of CO2 on the Earth. Sorry, it's a C. And 3 billion tons is what the Earth can absorb naturally in the ocean through trees. So this is how much the Earth is prepared to take care of for us. And so that little 4 down there is how much over we are. Extra tons is what we're emitting. Kind of a shock, huh?
So is the assumption that, say, 100 years ago, we only emitted as much as the Earth?
I think. I mean, he didn't. I took a lot of good notes on that, and he didn't really.
Yeah, well, they've been able to track it.
Have they?
Over the centuries, mm-hmm. The growth has only occurred in the last 100 years.
Yeah.
Basically, since the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it is pretty recent. I mean, then what he went into were the causes of this, and so these are some more interesting numbers, and then we'll stop for a little more discussion. Here are the major causes. So for us, the main points to remember are weather is weird, it's getting warmer, 4 billion extra tons of CO2 a year, and here are the main causes for this. Coal-fired electricity and industry, he felt, or statistics show, give out 2.5 billion tons a year. Transportation, $1.5 billion. Methane, released by landfills and agriculture, was somewhat less. Still a big impact. I don't have that number. And then the impact of deforestation, and the warming of the oceans, which then reduces the Earth's capacity to absorb, also is a contributing fact. And he said there is a 90% chance that heat-trapping pollution is the main factor in global warming since 1950. And of course, there's a few more things before we stop and absorb all this, really get into our eco-anxiety. Here are the numbers behind our eco, you know, the first thing is face the facts, right? I won't write this down, but he said, if we're not going to change this, then the Earth could warm by 4 to 11 degrees in the future. I didn't take notes on exactly when that is. So he was saying, again, speaking from Chicago, if nothing happens, then in 100 years, the climate in northern Illinois will be like the climate of East Texas today. That's what Illinois would be like. So I won't go skiing anymore. And the Great Lakes would be 4 or 5 feet lower than today, which would basically mean no shipping. If you look at the Sault Ste. Marie locks, nobody's going to be able to get through those. And Superior, Michigan, won't be used for shipping.
Excuse me. You hear so often that because of global warming, the polar caps are depleting their ice. That's raising.
No. No. You're saying no.
Well.
Scientists
in Antarctica, it is because the ice is on the land.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
In the Arctic, the ice is in the water, so when it melts,
it's already there.
There's a
it
little
doesn't.
Bit of increase due to the change in density, but nothing very
significant. I think it's more about the capacity of the ice cap to reflect heat back and away from the Earth is more about that. But thank you. That's an interesting clarification. Just a last couple of facts, and then we'll sit and... Yeah, it says here, ice caps reflect back heat to the sun, and we're losing that. But it's interesting that Steve Kramer, the very, very tall man who just arrived to be utilities coordinator for the next year, said this is, you know, he can't prove this, and maybe it's bad science, but people are saying if we just, like, painted every flat roof white with reflective, that'd be a good substitute and would do a lot to cut down heat. So my building in Chicago had a flat roof that was white and reflective. So he had a lot more to say, but basically he said to avoid the scenario of continuing billions and billions of extra tons of CO2 and a very dismaying global temperature in the future, of course we have to cut emissions by half worldwide. But this is interesting, he said, the world has to cut emissions by half. We, to really take responsibility for what we put into it, in North America would have to cut by 60 to 80% emissions because our per capita use is so much higher than everybody else's. And I know the ELCA World Hunger Appeal and Global Mission, as the development arm is looking at how to fund projects, there's a lot more emphasis now on adaptation. How can the hunger funds that are going out in global projects be used to help people in vulnerable places who are likely to be displaced or have their ability to support themselves destabilized by global warming? What kind of adaptive measures can people begin to do now? And that's a new focus for the way that ELCA World Hunger Funds are being spent. And there's also a movement, and I'm not the expert, and I don't know if I'm going to use the right word for this, but it's like reparations. Reparations is the politically charged word. There's something that's a little more neutral. But that, too, in the development world is a kind of a growing movement that would say that, you know, countries that have put this much CO2 in the atmosphere really should be stepping up and giving more in development and emergency money to people who are going to suffer. You know, that one of the big groups that's leading the discussion around global warming is the Union of Island nations, because they're all going to disappear. So, and what does anyone know? Is it what's the name of the country that's just basically making plans to move? There's one little island out there, and like they bought some new real estate because they can't stay, and they're projected to be one of the first to go. So, anyway, are you feeling a little eco anxiety? any comments on this? Any other comments or questions? And if anybody, I mean, I appreciate everyone who's got more technical background. This is me channeling a weatherman.
It strikes me funny that in all the causes that you have there, why do you suppose? course, overpopulation is not one of them.
Well, that's interesting. I do have a little card.
I mean, a lot of this overpopulation would cause a lot of this stuff.
Yes, but...
For some reason, people don't talk about that.
Well, it's because it depends on the consumption rate. I'm really sorry to tell you. I don't have this. Jared Diamond, you know, he writes a lot. And do I hear it? Jared Diamond, who has written a lot of things, books. He said, you'd think that population would be a thing here. So, I'm channeling facts I've written down over the years that are interesting. He said, the total... Let me see if I can get this. Basically... People who live in North America, Western Europe, Japan, and Australia consume resources like oil and metals and produce waste like plastic and greenhouse gases at a rate that's 32 times higher than the developing world. So Kenya maybe has 30 million people, but their factor of consumption is 1. So if you multiply 30 times 1, you get 30. If there's 5 billion people in the developing world, but we consume at the rate of 32, what is that even right there? More than 180, what is it? 300 million people in North America times 32 means that the United States consumes 320 times more resources than Kenya. And in terms of output of all these things, they're pretty much on our side. You know, small herds of nomadic cows in Kenya that people are driving around are not producing the methane that very large feedlots in the North America. On the other hand, we're working on how to produce energy out of methane, so there's, for all these, there's an interesting adaptation. But that's, so population, of course, is a concern for the overall sustainability of the Earth, but we have to take responsibility for how much more our small slice of the world is consuming and contributing to this, and that's the basis for the idea that we would have to cut by 60 to 80% of our usage.
Mm-hmm. With regard to methane, the tundra is melting and softening. There's recent information that I've read in the last 6 months to a year that all of the fibers and all of the carbon products that are in the tundra, as they start to decompose because they're now above 32 degrees, basically, will produce something like 5 times more methane than is produced by anything and all other things. Right now. So more anxiety for you there.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. So
methane may even move to the top, is what I'm
saying. It may. And on deforestation, I had written down a couple more, you know, fabulous facts.
Methane is more dangerous than carbon dioxide as well.
So
more of that increases the...
Why is it more dangerous than carbon dioxide? I don't know
the scientific reason, but it is...
Heat
absorption.
Heat absorption.
For a given volume of methane and carbon dioxide.
So in other words, it's able to absorb more heat from the sun, which increases the temperature.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And then there's sulfur oxide, or something that's even worse than that, that's mostly from gasoline.
I have a question for the group. How do you respond to someone who says, I don't believe in global warming?
Yeah.
Other than you, ignorant.
Yeah.
That was what this weatherman was saying. Basically, he said, you know, I'm assuming you're all here for Earth Day and you believe, but in case you don't, he was laying it out this way. So when he said it's a 90% chance that heat trapping pollution is the main factor in warming since 1950, a 90% chance. Okay, so there's the 10%. Do you want to debate?
Well, along that line, there's general scientific consensus is yes, there global warming is happening. Where the quibbling is how fast it's happening, and, you know, how much effect we actually have on it. But it's pretty much undeniable that
something
is happening.
Is
increasing
temperature. I think Russia denies it.
Really?
Among other.
Yes.
But no credible. The question is, whether there's credible scientists who deny it.
Yeah.
And that, I don't think there's many.
I'm part of a sustainability task force in Spokane, Washington. We worked for a year on this, 500 people, and when it came to the city council to approve very minimal steps to help mediate things as an eventual thing without any costs attendant, the
those folks came to the city council and basically said that it's part of a conspiracy from the United Nations. And there is a coterie of folks that do in fact believe that. And certainly they're entitled to their feelings and their beliefs, but they can't argue with the facts.
Was there an impact? I mean, did that affect what happened because of your...
Yeah, the Sustainability Tax Force took 3 weeks to get approved. The report took 3 weeks to be approved. And the furor is unbelievable. And Spokane is, by the way, a microcosm of the Midwest. We test every fast food restaurant that ever got started in the United States to Spokane first, because our demographics are about that.
Well, here we are at the nadir of eco-anxiety. We're just going to feel it first. Is there anybody else? I'm hoping to cheer us up eventually.
Well, I'll just bring up another resource, yeah. And that is Cliff Mass. I don't know whether people have heard of him. He's a professor at the University of Washington. He's written wonderful books.
How do you spell his name?
Cliff Mass, M-A-S-S.
M-A-S-S?
Yeah. And he's
got
a... I'm sorry, excuse me, I'm correct. M-A-A-S. He's got a blog, and he's very good at explaining things in layman terms. And, of course, he's a weatherman, he's a meteorologist.
See, that's it. It was really instructive to think, these are scientists that communicate with us all the time,
right.
Every day.
And he's addressed the climate change thing, basically introducing what you said, and that is there's climate change, which scientists understand, and there's variability, which all of us are going, God, is it hot today?
Yeah.
You know, it must be, you know, the end of the world.
Yeah.
He's causing effects.
So his blog, I mean, does he offer, we're going to move into what this weatherman talked about, things we can do.
Yeah.
Does he also focus on that too? I mean,
well, to some extent,
to help us with our eco-anxiety?
I guess one of his biggest things is actually trying to improve weather and climate measurement. Especially because the Pacific Northwest has so lack of data coming out of the Pacific Ocean and stuff like that. But at the same time, I think he's very good just in terms of bringing the science down to the layman's level. That would be my best recommendation.
That was what this guy did really well, too. So let me tell you a couple things then that this guy then said. You know, if it's up to us to cut our emissions by 60 to 80%, how are we going to do that? And so here were his top areas. So first of all, energy efficiency and conservation. Now, well, let me write these down and then I'll give you the numbers. That says conservation, okay? Building better cars and transportation systems. Moving to renewable energy and biofuel. And removing carbon from fossil fuels. He has a figure of 100% here, and I don't think that this means 100, maybe you can help me with the math. And again, statistics? No, I didn't do that. I think he said that 100, if this is 100% of the effort to change, I don't know that this is 100% elimination. This is sort of like if we have 100% choice of where to put our energy. He said 40%, if we invested 40% into energy efficiency and conservation, this is the area that would give the greatest payback right now and do the most, which is something that I think also as individuals we have quite a bit to say about. He did note, and I remember again, Doug Carlson, this guy from the National Atmospheric Place in Boulder who presented here years ago, said that really if you look at it, our market, our economy is a lot less carbon-based than it was 100 years ago. Every year, our carbon-based economy, the amount of it that's fueled actually by carbon gets smaller. And we get more and more efficient all the time. Just think about our refrigerators today versus refrigerators 40 years ago. But the problem is we keep coming up with new ways to use the power, so there's no net reduction. We get more efficient and we invent new stuff. And so all the same power is still being used in the same system. So if we figured that one out, this would have the greatest impact, he said. Building better cars and a transportation system, he said, would be 25%. Would be the next greatest payback area. Developing renewable renewable, I should say renewable, energy and biofuel will be 20%, and then removing carbon from fossil fuels, e.g. coal, would be 15%. So this would be kind of the hierarchy of effectiveness. Anybody have any reactions to that? I'm going to make this smaller so we have...
Ian, mm-hmm. our son works for United Airlines, and he's on a task force because, you know, air travel is a significant contributor
yes.
in
uh-huh.
emissions.
Uh-huh.
And he's on a task force that's working on that and looking at that. But
they're looking at different fuel sources, aren't they? I've heard that they're
right,
looking for...
Well, they are, but
algae,
you know, he reports it's a long way from
yeah.
being... commercial use or
uh-huh.
or that, but I guess we need to recognize that it's, in addition to better cars, there's other transit systems
yeah.
mm-hmm. that are
trains and boats.
Mm-hmm.
Any other reactions? Or this is where I can just start writing notes.
So
when
you're
talking about
energy and efficiency and conservation is distinct from all those other...
Yeah, I think this is just, you know, he said, you know, basically like, you know, change your light bulbs, buy energy efficient appliances, use less. I mean, I've been noticing this year at Holden how maybe because we're just making that power right there, we leave a lot of lights on all night. You know, library lights are on all night. I mean, maybe that's also for the security of being out in the dark, but even... Well, I do know that the ELCA building is looking at that to make sure that lights get turned off at night, because the last person
yeah,
out doesn't always do that.
High to me if the
well, that's it's sort of counterintuitive, but it's kind of good news, right? Because this is, I mean, you and we are not going to be probably involved in our professional lives inventing new sources of energy or removing carbon from fossil, but this is a place where I think here is a place where you know an individual's. Decisions actually do meet up with an important change or systemic change. Mm-hmm.
All of these things are based upon individual behaviors, but individuals,
yeah.
you know, only
right.
1 in 100 might have an impact unless you know, the federal government and the states get behind
right.
these projects, which in
right.
turn is dependent upon
right.
individual studies and research and
this is true. Right. This is, again, we're looking at, like, there's advocacy and legislation, and then there's the individual, and how do those things, how does one person's choice meet up with this, or how does the ability to legislate change meet up with our own habits? They're definitely connected. Maybe this cash for clunkers is, you know, are they actually taking terrible things off the road? Okay, John.
Actually,
no.
There's statistics that show that using a car that you have already built, building a new car uses tremendous amount.
More resources,
so
and it's true. That's a good point.
The engine in your old car, and
yeah.
whatever, and not the long term, but as cars absolutely need to be replaced, yes. But
so that was more about economic stimulus
car,
than
buy a new car and save
okay.
2 miles a gallon.
Yeah.
Well, money. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. That's a good thing to keep in mind. Speaking of lenses and things to just think about. Yeah, there's a lot of figures about like how you can measure how much energy there is in anything, you know, how much energy it took to make that, and the whole field of life cycle analysis sort of would look at that.
One other quick comment on the sustainability thing. Water is also a resource we need to be concerned about. Spokane sits on top of an aquifer that's equivalent to the Columbia River. Mm-hmm. The people in Spokane, Washington, use more gallons of water per capita than any other place in the world.
Really?
They use 250 mm-hmm. gallons per day. As opposed to Kenya, where they use 3 or 4 gallons per day. Mm-hmm. We brought that to the city council, and to have people just water times the day they would conserve a little water, mm-hmm. you'd have thought you were trying to take your firstborn child away from them. Unbelievable. I mean, just, can't you cut your water consumption?
It's a big shift. It's a big shift for us to start thinking this way. Same thing in Chicago. It's like, save water, there's a lake out there. What are you talking about? Well, that's, you know, remember you're all co-conspirators. We're here to figure out how we can do it and model and help others do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of car efficiency, we've already found that out. Just get gasoline up to $4 or $5
I was going to say the same thing that you were talking about, I guess, 2 nights ago, in terms of simplicity. Consume less.
Yeah.
Go carless.
Yeah.
You know, use less electricity.
Yeah.
You know, create less waste, those kinds of things may do a lot more than maybe some of these other technological changes.
Okay, yes, I'll get back to that.
Oh, I just finished reading an article in this month's Atlantic Magazine about this guy who did research about effective messages on conservation.
Mm-hmm.
He started off working for a hotel chain.
Mm-hmm.
He found out that the most effective way to persuade people to reuse their towels was to say 70% of the guests who stayed in this room in the past reuse their towels.
Oh, and then this is...
And that worked. As opposed to saying, please reuse your towel, it saves water, it's good for the environment. That was effective to a certain degree, but not as effective as the comparative message. And now what he's doing is working with utilities in California. And what they've got these computer models set up that can obtain an average electrical consumption figure for a neighborhood, part of a city. And so the message on your bill says, congratulations, you use 39% less electricity than your neighbors this month. And that's proved to be amazingly effective because it's like, hey, wow, all right, I'm doing good.
Well, yeah, it quantifies it and lets you know what you're doing.
Yeah. And the other message also goes out of saying you used 70% more electricity than it says that on your bill. You use 70% more than the average consumption in your neighborhood. They found that that's a very powerful message. It actually gets through to people. Much better than it's in your best interest economically or you're saving the earth, which are good messages. It's just that.
But there's too abstract, don't you think? I mean, people just, they aren't motivating, but knowing how much. I told you yesterday about how cranky I was last fall after all sorts of things, and I was a terrible presenter then. And then I came back and talked all about simplicity and green at my church. In the basement for the Advent season, and we have a woman who's, she's very tiny, and she's in her 70s, and she's a lawyer on the Illinois Human Rights Court or something. Anyway, she is a lawyer through and through. I mean, she's, when our church debated sexuality, there were only people on one side, so she went out and copied all the other arguments and stood in for the other side, you know, because she is so concerned that all voices be heard. And so she said, you know, Anne, I go to the grocery store, I look at my food and it says it's 110 calories and 100% of my vitamin C. I know that from those nutritional labels, but how do I know what's green? How do I know what's going to help this? And that kind of thing. I mean, she wants to do it, but she feels completely clueless because we're saying, you know, it'd be good to the earth. She needs instructions. And that kind of feedback really does, it gives instructions as well as encouraging people. Okay, let me move on to other things. Yes, this weatherman did say, he said in the what you can do category, he said, raise your voice, choose an efficient vehicle, buy energy efficient appliances, walk, bike, take mass transit, and change your light bulbs. He was just going for, like, you know, what would they say, taking the, just sort of doing the simplest things that will yield the most. It was interesting to me, too, to realize that about this energy efficiency and consumption. This is another Jared Diamond fact. It's not that we could cut way back without cutting back on comfort. Jared Diamond says, per capita oil consumption in Western Europe is half of North American consumption, and living standards equal or exceed ours in Europe. So somehow, again, that's a structural system. Something about the way it's structured there ends up using half of the energy that we do. So oil, which would be really interesting. So getting back to eco-anxiety, and then let's keep looking at more ideas here, which they defined it earlier, or I mentioned to you earlier, the walking worried, who worry about this stuff and don't know what to do. How can we treat our eco-anxiety? I think theologically we could start with confession, just like we do at church. We can say, you know, we can begin to take some responsibility for the fact that we've been part of systems, you know, that have done this, and we, through our choices, have as well. And even in 12 steps, right, you kind of start with, I am powerless over this, and then you can start the healing. So I think we have to kind of say our part as a step to moving into moving away or moving through eco-anxiety. And the second thing that has occurred to me is, you know, we have to understand what our power is. We all walk around all day denying our power and influence. And when I mentioned that I was a little grouchy again last fall because at the ELCA building, they were looking at finally starting finally starting to institutionalize the effort to make the building greener. The thing that frustrated me most was that people would say, well, no, I'm not in charge. There's nothing I can do that will affect these people. I'm not the person with the power. I mean, you understand in the org chart what power you have for the decisions and the area of responsibility you have, but nobody seemed to be able to define exactly who had the power to change the system of how things were bought or, you know, fuel was used. It took a long time to have people discover who was in charge of that. And so I think in our working environments as well as our home, you know, first of all, think, you know, what is, how much do you have to say about things, and who are the people who have stuff to say, and how can you just be part of the people who say, we have the power to make the change, and now what can we do, instead of saying, I don't know, I can't, you know, persuade 450 people to leave their cars at home. And then I think also in this whole eco-anxiety thing, when we were talking yesterday about lenses that we look through, and then I mentioned this quote from Carl Jung. Was anybody here for the first time who wasn't here yesterday? Okay, so this great quote from Carl Jung, the Jungian psychologist, he said, all the greatest and important problems of life are fundamentally insoluble. They can never be solved, only outgrown. Real change results when we embrace a higher or a wider interest. And then the problem fades away when there's like a new way of seeing things or a new urge. So it I guess maybe a positive thing about this, the news is so terrible, maybe it's going to help us embrace some kind of a higher common interest that says if we're even going to be here, and we might not, even our best efforts might, you know, keep butterflies alive and not us, but maybe this is a moment where this higher interest that can unite us, or a lens that, you know, can change so we can see and act differently, can take place. So confess, take responsibility, be creative. Anybody? So we have Cliff Moss, water, Spokane sustainability. Now I'm just opening it up for comments or ideas. Okay, Alita, and then you, I guess.
Just want to comment on the sort of intersection between individual or community action and advocacy and legislation. In Wisconsin, there's a focus on energy fund, and I'm not sure exact. I think it comes from energy taxes, where a certain percentage is set aside for promoting renewable energy sources and change. Our congregation applied for and jumped through all sorts of hoops to install solar panels on the front of our historic Central City building. And it ended up costing us a fair amount of money to install. My husband wrote the grants, I think 10 panels. So he could speak to it more efficiently. Ultimately, it's going to take us a long time to recover the cost of those panels in energy cost savings for the church. But there was a groundswell, if you will, that this was the right thing to do, that we were early adapters, and if we took advantage of this program, perhaps it would encourage others, and so there was certainly the contingent in the congregation that said, well, this doesn't make sense, we should spend the $25,000, we can earn our money back faster in a money market account than investing in these solar panels that, but ultimately it did pass. The solar panels are on the building. And some of the objectors are the ones that are checking all the time the website that tells us exactly how much energy is being generated and what we should be getting back, and they're just fascinated.
So are you generating it for the use of the congregation, or are you selling it back to the utility in Milwaukee?
The technology right now is not there for us to just capture it. So it goes into the general electricity supply, and the the electric company gives us a credit every month based on the energy that was generated by these panels.
Oh, so instead of paying an electrical bill?
Well, that was the objection. We still have to pay an electrical bill.
Oh,
it's anywhere from 8 to 12% less than it was because of what we're generating through these panels. Hmm. The initial investment didn't really justify the 8 to 12% savings annually. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was still the right thing to do. A community came together and said, you know, as caretakers of this good earth, we need
to do that.
To do this.
That is an advantage that churches have that, you know, kind of answers the people who come out and say, that's a UN conspiracy. I mean, the phrase you're using, the right thing to do. I mean, as a church, we can decide to do that, and we don't really have to listen to people who say it's a UN conspiracy. We can just act and make changes. Actually, he was first. I'm sorry.
But we would not have done it had there not been the legislation in place to put aside money to help us, to encourage us to do
so. Public advocacy led to a situation where the church could
allow that money to be set aside, the fund, you know, that encouraged the development of this program, worked together with
the church.
You know, the church and other, I mean, it isn't just the church that's taking advantage of that program, but, and that there are several ELCA congregations in Greater Milwaukee now that are taking part in that.
You are next, but you can name names, I don't know, are you?
No, it's Larry.
Larry?
Yeah.
Larry.
There are other ideas coming out of the woodwork which sound very simplistic and sort of appealing, which is basically find some way to shield the earth from the excess sunlight that's, you know, creating the heat to reflect it back into space. And then we can burn all the carbon we want.
Oh! Are you on that bandwagon?
No.
Okay.
Well, where I worked a couple of years ago, the city manager challenged everybody to see if we could reduce fuel use by 10% citywide. And so I just opened that up to the folks in my group, and I asked them, okay, look at everything we do and see if you can think of a way we could cut down our use of gas. Mm-hmm. And we met a week later, and it was Garth. He stuck up his hand first and said, hey, John, how about instead of putting door tags on people's doors, why don't we just mail those out? And, you know, we've been putting door tags on, well, I guess, delinquent utility customers' doors for probably 20 years. Always been done that way. And I thought, well, why not? Why can't we? And so we did a cost comparison. I mean, that was 8% of our 10% was saved right there by changing that process. And when I asked the person I report to if we could do this, he was like, gosh, we've done it there. And he said, you know, just go for it. Let's try it. Mm. And okay, now it takes somebody in the office 2 hours total, start to finish, to produce the same notice, get it in the mail, and mail it out to our, you know, slow-paying customers. In the past, we had 4 water meter readers driving all over the city, hanging these door tags on people's doors. Wow. And just one change was just incredible. The impact of that and cost, and that freed up all kinds of time for other work. And Dean asked me to track complaints. And we have about 20,000 utility customers. I got 3 complaints over the
that they didn't get a cutoff notice on their door.
Right. And this is after I tracked it for 3 months and I got a total of 3 complaints.
There's a lot more of this like kind of competitive stuff happening. I haven't really done this myself, but there's like something called I've just kind of read this, not participated, but I was trying to sell the ELCA on that. Like, why not just have one unit just pit us against each other? It's not un-Christian. carbonrally.com is a place where offices like would compete with each other to see who conserves more. So if you said something like that, and you said, well, Division for Church and Society, say 15% more paper than Division for Global Mission, we would pay attention. I mean, it's kind of fun. It's not really cutthroat competition. It's competition that leads to a good outcome.
Because Steve didn't say we had to reduce it by 10% no matter what.
Yeah.
And we were going to be punished if we failed. He just said, make every effort. Mm-hmm. See what you can do. And he said, it's all open, it's all on the table. Make whatever reasonable changes you want to make to try to achieve the goal. And a lot of good ideas come out of that.
Great. Let's see.
I'm just curious, Quick question, how many churches represented here have a green committee or person who's trying to cut down on and conserve? And one, two, three.
I was the single person and I was, it wasn't very supported, so I've kind of backed down a little bit because it's too much effort.
Yes.
Yeah. I took this, I did a temple talk one time and I took the styrofoam cups that were being used. Mm-hmm. The polystyrene. and I threw it in there and said, we don't need any of these. We have all these ceramic mugs, you know. Let's use them. Let's form dish teams. And you know, like 2 weeks in a row, I got people to volunteer to wash the dishes. And after that, it was figured out. Yeah. They went back to the styrofoam stuff.
It would be interesting to see whether a synod could have some kind of an intercongregation little competition, then report the results at the Synod Assembly. You know, maybe there's ways that we can use our structure to collectively, make you not a lone voice.
Yeah.
We used to live in Ohio, and there was a guy, I think it was on the Synod Council, that was some kind of engineer or lighting specialist, and he would come to any congregation to do an energy audit. So he came clear down to southern Ohio to look at our church, you know, and gave us, you know, changed the spotlights on the altar, you know, to a different kind of spotlights. Now, people didn't like it very well at first because they were a little bit different color. But, you know, they got used to it. But the electric company sent out in the bill, you know, that we'll change the fixture, your outdoor. Dusk to dawn light will change the fixture to more energy efficient. And I just signed it and sent it back. Oh, the council beat me up for doing that without asking them. I was going to save them money, you know.
In Chicago, I've been part of this, I can't even remember what the acronym stands for, RHEP, Residential Energy, I don't know, but I have a meter that charges me, or I did till I sold my house, charges me exactly the rate at that moment instead of the this is the day rate, that's the night rate. So the idea is that then, you know, and I always did, you know, so you run your dishwasher at 11:30 at night when you go to bed, and you're paying half a cent a kilowatt. If you run it at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in July, you're gonna pay 12 cents a kilowatt. So the idea is for people to, when you know exactly what you're paying, you have more control over when you wanna do it.
What's the old saying? If you don't measure it, you don't take care of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Other? Yes, John.
Yeah. Other people talk. I've talked a lot. Avista Utilities in Spokane, you can actually hook up to the power grid with your solar panels and use your own power or sell your power back. Mm-hmm. Mary, my partner's wanting to put solar panels on her house, and it's even with the big tax credit, which basically undergirds all of this, the 1,500 watts you can get off of your roof in Spokane, the sun shines a fair amount, but not all the time. You can effect the same change in your electricity use and consumption and bill by turning off the four big spotlights in the kitchen when you go out of the room.
Yeah.
And I've been arguing that. I'm not winning, but I'm arguing that.
Yeah.
And so the payback really is quite lengthy and all stuff, but it's a witness, if you would, for your church to do that.
Yeah. I think that's why this guy was saying, you know, looking at energy efficiency and conservation, just if you you don't leave your, well.
It's like a 15-year payback.
Right, so, but if you just, like, you know, charge your phone for 2 hours and then unplugged it instead of leaving it all overnight, or, you know, everybody knows about all your appliances that really never are off but are always on. How much of the United States electricity consumption goes to computers that are idling and TV sets? Anything with a remote, basically, is never off. So they say, you know, you probably already know this, but you plug those things into a power strip. And then someone says, but how do I program my TV to be able to record my shows? I said, I don't know.
Yeah, every time your TV is shut off, you have to reprogram the channel, so it's like really pain.
Yeah.
So I'd say just to have a TV. That's me.
Price convenience.
How much more time do we have? Are we at?
It's 5 after 7.
Awesome. Cruising towards the end. Okay. John mentioned the word sustainability. That's a big word this year. How does your core group in Spokane define sustainability?
Well, the core group is actually started by our new mayor, and she got 15 highly placed people, the Vista president of Vista and others, to jump on board with this. Mary's actually on the sustainability task force, and she's gone back as a second career and gotten a degree, and she's LEED certified for these buildings, and she's green professional, all that, looking at a new career. It's very complex, but the simple thing is that there's big money to be made in retrofitting.
Yeah.
She's a dean at the community college, and they're looking at the new veterans program, training the veterans to come in and learn how to do green
to retrofit.
Green refurb, basically.
Yeah. But do you have, is there a, I mean, this is a word that we kind of, it makes sense sort of intuitively, but do you have a nice simple definition?
This has to do with your ability to maintain your current lifestyle, and if you think about it, the current catchphrase is urban walkable versus suburban drivable. And most new communities, even in Spokane, are still being built as suburban. The recent Habitat for Humanity house was built 18 miles from downtown Spokane. So a low-income family that's making a living and buying a house when fuel prices go up is going to have difficulty because the Christian organization has chosen to build something
far away.
Far away. And we're working on a light rail system in Spokane. Mm-hmm. I spent $8 million on pre-planning and trying to get them to even get it to come to a vote is just horrible. But a backbone from the airport to Coeur d'Alene would support urban walkable because at each train station you build, you develop a community, like
around
in France,
yeah.
like in Germany.
Yeah.
All the little services you need, housing and whatever, mostly are right where right, you get off the train at night.
That was a walkscore.com. For those of you who are new, yesterday someone who was in the session talked about a website called walkscore.com. And you can enter any address and it'll help you evaluate the walk from what was it, like Walker's Paradise to, Driver's Nightmare, maybe is the other one. A way to evaluate your community or find communities that support a pedestrian lifestyle.
European lifestyles, you go to the grocery store every day and you walk.
Yeah.
How many of us in this room can walk to our local grocery store and carry our groceries? I can't, but if you're living suburban lifestyle, it's 15 minutes.
It takes, there's a lot tied into that. I wrote down two definitions of sustainability because the ELCA we're starting to use this all the time everywhere, and it's just one of those big undefined, catchwords that's everywhere. We're guilty of that a lot. One, here's kind of a social science-y definition and then kind of a clear one. The social science-y definition that came from some UN paper is sustainable development is development that meets the needs of the present without the compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. And then Vicki Robin from Seattle said it more simply. She said, to her, sustainability means living today as if there will be many tomorrows and many creatures who need the living systems that are now present, which is a big shift, I think, for our country. Really, we really haven't had to look at things that way. So about eco-anxiety, I was going to say, to be compassionate, I think we have to recognize we're definitely, as a country, kind of in between lenses on this. We don't see sustainability yet. We're still, yelling about metered water. We do that in Chicago, too. There's a big lake. Why do you have to meter my water? So there are a lot of people who haven't, I don't want to put anybody down. But not everybody in the United States feels the same urgency around this issue, put it that way. And so as we move forward, I think the church is, a bottom line for me is the church community is a powerful community that can support people through changes like this, and I love hearing stories like the solar panels in Milwaukee and how congregations and church communities are taking advantage of the assets we have, which is a great gospel, a lot of people, buildings, places to meet. I'll talk about this more on Friday, but one characteristic of churches is really, if you think about it, church space, church having coffee, you know, coming and worshiping. It's almost, it's one of the few public spaces in the United States that's not given over to shopping, is church space. So it's valuable what can happen there and what we can do. So I don't want to leave us in eco-anxiety. I want us to suffer, and then I want us to take responsibility and confess and try to figure out how to, you know, even just look at what light bulbs we turn off. And, you know, small steps are a good place to begin. And when I feel optimistic, it's because I think that, you know, things are shifting. And we talked yesterday about economics. You know, everybody is racing to figure out how to make products greener and more efficient. And so partly we'll be able to, I hope, ride a wave. The only problem is it's not always a permanent wave. Sometimes it's a fad. But I'm kind of optimistic in thinking that we almost can't help but move in that direction, or we're basically dead.
Mm-hmm. Well, another source to bring to the discussion is Thomas Friedman's book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded. Mm-hmm. And he has an interesting phrase that he uses as the green ball, green economy gets mm-hmm. going. And it's out-greening, which means that if your company goes green, I'm looking at how to make my company more efficient so that I can outgreen you.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that he sees America as being really good at.
Yeah, we're really
and
competitive.
That's where his performance.
Yeah, we could do that. That sort of gets back to the message you were talking about. You know, you used more energy than 79% of your neighbors. That kind of spurs you to try to outgreen.
I can tell you a thing of a success story in our little community. The city engineer and the city council decided they were not going to replace boulevard trees because the tree roots get in the, you know, whatever,
sewer
pipes. And somebody might walk into a tree and sue the city. So a whole bunch of us went, and we had all these things like, you know, wouldn't you rather walk in West St. Paul, or why do we have to go to St. Paul to walk so we get sidewalks and trees? You know, why can't we have them? And many of us moved into this community because of trees. He was not buying it one little bit. The more we talked about it, I mean, many meetings, and it just got... All of a sudden, at one meeting, a little lady who had done her research said, do you realize, Mr. Whatever his name is, that the asphalt will last 20 years longer if it's shaded? No problem. Trees will come. It was just like, where can you find that little niche that will get someone to change their mind?
Uh-huh.
We haven't seen the trees yet.
But they're on their
now way. There's no money. But yeah. But the attitude has changed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's great.
That's funny.
Well, we can wrap up and move on to Vespers. Tomorrow we're going to, with our conversation sort of about, you know, what's the positive message of simplicity. It'll be kind of a messaging conversation because so many people associate simplicity and frugality with I lost my job, or you know, it just gets kind of negative. So I was taking notes all week. There'll be some things we'll follow up with there. And Friday is my church basement says Cells of Resistance talk, where we'll really talk a lot more about what we can do in congregations. And I have a handout that I can give you Friday. So two more days left. Thank you for everyone's wisdom. Look forward to hearing more.